This podcast is sponsored by Brodo. If your morning coffee isn't cutting it lately, it's time for a change. Brodo's bone broth is the simplest nutrition upgrade you can make to your daily routine. Their broths are made from scratch, no concentrates, preservatives, or shortcuts, so you get the best broth money can buy. Created by Marco Canora, a James Beard award-winning chef, Brodo started as a local New York City secret served through a restaurant window. Now Brodo ships nationwide, so you don't have to be in New York City to enjoy Chef Marco's masterpiece. Each cup delivers whole food protein, about 10 grams per serving, along with collagen-building amino acids, electrolytes, and nutrients to help you feel your best, all under 50 calories and with zero sugar or fat. Delicious bone broth.
You a big fan?
Big fan.
I'm more of a Bilbo fan than Brodo.
That's a bad joke for about the best books.
Tell me, there's 8 delicious flavors.
Okay, tell me more.
I like the classic chicken. Mm-hmm. They also have a spicy nana.
Okay, ooh.
Which is also good. And then they have more creative blends like ginger turmeric.
Mm-hmm.
Herb infused.
What about for the vegetarian in my life?
Well, there's veggie-based broth.
Oh, nice. Okay.
So, there you
go. They got it all, is what you're telling me.
You can pick up their sampler pack and then you can find your favorite.
Just try them all.
Highly recommend. Shop the best broth on the planet with Brodo. Head to brodo.com/offline for 20% off your first subscription order and use code offline for an additional $10 off. Once again, that's brodo.com/offline for 20% off your first subscription order and an additional $10 off if you use my promo code offline.
There's the story you hear, and then there's the story behind it. Who's telling it? What are their motivations? What's at stake? I'm Brian Reed, and on my show from KCRW, Question Everything, we tell stories about power and influence and the ways that people are manipulating the truth. And we do that by talking to the people living with the consequences.
My feed was flooded without my consent. I was targeted by Instagram.
Listen to Question Everything, wherever you get your podcasts.
Peter Thiel, in October, he had these Antichrist lectures, but he calls Leo XIV the woke American Pope. And his biggest fear, he says, is that the woke American Pope will work with AOC for a Marxist Catholic fusion presidency. So these guys are...
Fingers crossed.
Exactly. We'll take it.
I'm Jon Favreau, and you just heard from today's guest, Christopher Hale, editor of the fantastic Letters from Leo Substack, and someone who spent years advising Democratic campaigns and faith-based groups on religion's role in public life. I want to read you something written last week that I haven't been able to stop thinking about. Artificial intelligence systems increasingly shape and permeate our mentality and social environments. Like every great historical transformation, this too calls not only for technical competence, but also for a humanistic formation capable of making visible the logic behind economics, embedded biases, and forms of power that shape our perception of reality. Within digital environments, structured to persuade, interaction is optimized to the point of rendering a real encounter superfluous. The otherness of persons in the flesh is neutralized, and relationships are reduced to functional responses. Dear friends, you, however, are real persons. Creation itself has a body, a breath, a life to be listened to and safeguarded. When simulation becomes the norm, it weakens the human capacity for discernment. As a result, our social bonds close in upon themselves, forming self-referential circuits that no longer expose us to reality. We thus come to live within bubbles, impermeable to one another, feeling threatened by anyone who is different. We grow unaccustomed to encounter and dialogue. In this way, polarization, conflict, fear, and violence spread. What is at stake is not merely the risk of error, but a transformation in our very relationship with truth. Maybe you've guessed already, but those aren't the words of a tech ethicist or a philosopher or a politician or a guest on this show. Yet, at least, they're the words of our woke offline Pope, Leo XIV. The Pope has, of course, been in the news quite a bit lately after Donald Trump attacked him as weak on crime and nuclear weapons. But what's gotten less attention is the focus he's placed on how technology, and specifically AI, is affecting our politics, our lives, our relationships, and our souls. Basically, everything we talk about on this show. I was raised Catholic, went to a Jesuit college, and then, like a lot of people, strayed from the church because of its external politics, its internal corruption, and my own personal doubts and skepticism, and to be honest, failings. I'm not quite back there just yet, but starting with Pope Francis and now Pope Leo, I've started to think that the Catholic Church as a moral, political force may have something to teach all of us, believers and non-believers alike, about how better to live with each other and treat each other and love each other in these incredibly fraught and troubled times. So who better to talk about this than Christopher Hale, a self-described struggling Catholic and heterodox Democrat who's been covering Leo's papacy and especially its connection to U.S. politics more deeply and thoughtfully than any other reporter or observer out there. We talked about what makes Leo different, why Trump feels threatened by him, why our newly converted Catholic vice president feels the need to lecture him, Leo's views on AI and technology, and where it all fits into the debates we're having in American politics today. It's a special conversation, and I hope you'll enjoy it. And one quick note before we start, CrookedCon is back, and it's bigger and better than ever. It'll be this November 5th through 7th here in Washington, D.C. Bigger stages, more panels, more incredible speakers, and more chances to connect with other political sickos like you and me. Plus, live tapings of Love It or Leave It, Pod Save America, and Strict Scrutiny. So head to CrookedCon.com and sign up for updates, ticket release dates, lineup announcements, and lots more. Here's Christopher Hale. Christopher Hale, welcome.
Thank you for having me. I appreciate it.
So you describe yourself on your Substack as a struggling Catholic and a heterodox Democrat. So let's start there. What's struggling and what's heterodox?
You know, we're both millennials. And I think to be a Catholic and to be a millennial, which I think Gen Z, there's a lot of up-and-coming Catholics who don't really understand this, but we grew up in the midst of the sex abuse crisis. I know you grew up in the Northeast, where it's most prevalent, but even in the South, where I was growing up, it definitely colored everything that
I
saw. You
grew up in Tennessee?
Tennessee. It colored everything I experienced with Catholicism growing up. One of the things I think strange about being from the South, though, is I come from a place where Catholics are in the extreme minority. I grew up in a place where evangelicals were the predominant religion growing up. And so to be a Catholic in the South was actually to be to the left of culture. And that's not so much just experience in the Northeast and other parts of the country. We're conservative tradition. But in the South, when the alternative was the evangelicals, Catholics were the woke ones. They were the progressive ones. And so I struggle because to be a Catholic is to hold on to all the scars of the church. Obviously, we have more failures than can be counted. But I also think, too, I still hold on to that faith. And I see it as a very much a guiding force of my life. The older I get, to some degree, you can kind of see the roots and the reality that it still plays a role within you. So I'm a mass attending Catholic, which is rare for a Democrat. There's not many of us in the pews on Sunday, but it means something to me. So I struggle with the faith to some degree, but I rebel in the community of being a part of the church.
And so you ran for Congress in Tennessee.
Sure.
What did you think you were going to be doing with your life like 5 years ago, and how did letters from Leo, a Substack about this Pope, come to be a thing?
Well, so during my career, I worked on kind of these fringes of Catholic Church and Democratic politics. I, in some way, worked on Catholic outreach for every Democratic nominee since Barack Obama in 12. But I moved on with my career. I thought I was going to be elected member of Congress. I'm a Democrat from Tennessee, so it was a dumb idea. We have a lot of ambitions that aren't tested against reality. So I definitely did not think this would come back into my life. 5 years ago, we were in the middle of Francis's pontificate. And what you find about Francis is he was a prophetic pope. On Pod Save America, you all talked up Pope Francis again and again and again. He meant a lot to Democrats, to the American people.
Jesuit.
We're both Jesuit.
Yeah, I was going to say, I went to Holy Cross, so it's like I couldn't believe we had a Jesuit pope.
When we grew up, we were taught two things about the Catholic Church. One, there could never be a Jesuit that was elected pope. And two, there could never be an American that was elected pope. So the last 13 years have kind of put that to rest. But Francis was limited to some degree for his effectiveness and his ability to communicate to the American people for one reason. He didn't speak English, not well at all. He always had to speak to a translator, even when he came here in 2015. You saw that he also was oftentimes marginalized because he was from Argentina. He was a Peronist in the critic's mind. He wasn't from here. He didn't understand our way of life. So he's very easy for, if you didn't like what he said, to ignore him. So I wrote about the Catholic Church for a long time for Time magazine. And then when Pope Francis died last April, almost a year ago to the date, ironically, both Time and Newsweek competitors don't really have religion reporters. And so they both asked me to cover both the death of Pope Francis and the conclave that elected Leo XIV. Mm. So I spent most of last April and May in Rome, which is a much better alternative, I think, than what was going on here in D.C. at the time.
Yeah.
And when I wrote about Leo, you could tell immediately that him being an American was something that would be unique, and that he was going to be consumed differently. And so I remember being there that during the election, and when you're there in Rome, I was at the inauguration '09. I was at, you know, at every political rally you can imagine, Bernie Sanders in Union Square in New York City in 2016. So I've been to the biggest events. This by far was bigger. You could feel the entire earthquake, you know. I was in the loggia standing above it. You could see all Rome kind of gather there and run from different parts of the city. So to elect the Pope is always a monumental occasion, no matter who it is. But when it was an American, you could see immediately just consuming online media that people were paying attention. And so I started writing letters from Leo over the summer, and you could see it's not the quality of my writing, it's for the interest of people. The vast majority of my consumers are not religious. So I have a very secular crowd who is interested in the Catholic Pope. I actually think it's to some degree interesting because you see that a lot of my readership is very left-wing, very secular, but they're inspired by Pope Leo XIV. And Pope Leo has progressive tendencies. We'll talk a lot about him. But he's also not like a traditional progressive. He's Catholic. He has a grandmother's views on abortion, same-sex marriage, and contraceptives. But I thought and I saw that that didn't really matter to a lot of these people. And I thought it was a revelatory lesson maybe to our party that we can have heterodox leaders who don't always fit the mold of, you know, what's in and what's the correct position to have, and they can still inspire our base.
I remember reading before he was elected, just sort of following the coverage about who they were thinking of, and because I, as someone who loved Pope Francis and loved that he was a Jesuit and loved sort of his political orientation, thinking, are they going to have someone who's like Francis? Are they going to go more to the center or to the right? And I mean, Leo sort of came out of nowhere, but he wasn't immediately seen as like another Francis in his politics.
Correct.
How much do you think his Americanness had to do with his election?
Well, Donald Trump says it's the entirety of course, his election. Yeah. I mean, his argument is it's all about him. I don't think it had a big deal to play at all. I mean, the last tweet, this is always striking to me. Obviously, Leo is not a politician. He says it time and again. And the conclave has politics in it, but they claim, and I think there's truth to that, it's a religious event. Hmm. The last tweet that he has going into that conclave.
He's a poster. We love that he's a poster.
He is a poster. He is a poster. You can dig up his old tweets on at Dr. Prevost. His last tweet is criticizing Donald Trump for his relationship with the Salvadorian president. And so he criticized Trump again and again and again, and he didn't delete those tweets. And there was a big right-wing effort to kind of identify the liberals that shouldn't be elected. It was called the College of Cardinals Report. The right wing is very organized in the Catholic Church.
Ah.
And they created these reports about, here's the liberals that you should not elect, and they had all the dirt. And they passed out these reports well-funded. Koch brothers, part of it, fast out these reports to cardinals saying these are like, this is the dirt on these guys. They didn't find his Twitter account. They did not find Prevost's Twitter account, which was littered with criticisms for 7-8 years of Donald Trump.
I remember the first time people were passing them around, like for the first couple hours, it was, is this really his account or did someone just make this up? Is this fake? And it was his.
It was 500 followers, so it was not a very well-known account, but it was revelatory to, I think, how he understands American politics. I do not think he was elected because he was an American, but I'm religious. So my worldview on this is pretty simple. I think that in 1978, John Paul II was elected. We know he was the first non-Italian pope in about 450 years, and he was from Poland. And that's a little bit anachronistic because really he was from behind the Soviet wall.
Yeah.
And conservatives would argue, and I agree with them, that he really helped bring down communism, the Soviet Union in the 80s and 90s.
Right.
My worldview.
That's why conservatives love Pope
That okay, is. Well, why I think liberals might have the same opinion about Pope Leo XIV is he's from the behind the wall of, I would argue, MAGA authoritarianism. And so I think he's helping bring this down as well.
For people who are secular who don't know a lot about Pope Leo, can you talk about how he is, aside from language and where they're from, how he is different than Pope Francis in sure. both his background and his orientation and focus?
Sure. The best way I would describe it is Francis is the prophet. Leo is the lawyer. Hmm. And so Francis gets elected at 77 years old. He thinks he's going to die pretty soon. He only has one lung. So he's not someone who likes rules and procedures. And so the way he got things done in the Catholic Church was bypass the rules and procedures. He did not ingratiate himself with the organizations and structures that he could use to change the church's teaching or put his agenda forth. He was disorganized. Mm. The best way to describe it. So he used the pulpit and he used his voice time and again. That's why we consumed him so much in the United States. Leo is the youngest pope we've had since 1990. He was 69 when he was elected. Nice. And then 70 now. And so he thinks he has a longer tenure at hand. And he also realizes that he has these mechanisms available to him. So I think he's actually more able to achieve the agenda that Francis had. So best way to describe it is I think Francis's vision can be achieved through Leo.
Mm, okay. He said something on the plane last night, mm-hmm. I think. You reported on it last sure. night, I saw, that really stuck out at me. That I know that Pope Francis sort of talked like this, but I don't think he said it this explicitly, which is, he said, "I think it's very important to understand that the unity or division of the church should not resolve around sexual matters. We tend to think that when the church is talking about morality, that the only issue of morality is sexual. And in reality, I believe there are much greater, more important issues such as justice, equality, freedom of men and women, freedom of religion, that would all take priority before that particular issue."
He said it off the cuff, too. And I think what we see with Leo is when he speaks off the cuff, he is more prophetic. He's less juridical in how he speaks. And what that communicates to me is simpler, something that Pope Francis said in 2013, and this got a lot of play. He said, "If someone is gay and seeking the Lord in his words, who am I to judge?" And that was one of his big right. breakout moments. And he later said that the church is obsessed with abortion, same-sex marriage, and contraceptions. And so I think this is Leo's way of saying Francis is right, that and so that we do not need to put these issues over and above these other issues. And just to get in the weeds for a minute, this is really a 20th century creation. The Catholic Church that we grew up in was quite obsessed with these three issues.
Yes, one of the reasons that I sort of drifted away from the church.
And we find that millennials, the number one reason that they claim that they left the Catholic Church coming to age in this country was because of these three issues. And so Leo and Francis both have their finger to the wind. They understand that these are divisive issues. And his words that he said after that is these are not issues that the church, that unifies the church.
Right.
And so I think what he is saying is that these are not going to be a big theme of my pontificate. And let me put it in more explicit terms. Since he's been elected, he's talked about migration and war at a rate of over 100-1. Mm. Then he's talked about abortion and same-sex marriage, and he's not once brought up contraception. Wow. So I don't think church teaching is going to change, but as you know, it's hard to change church teaching.
I was going
to
say, that's a...
We believe it's biblical, so it's really hard to, to overrule some of this stuff, but you can put the emphasis elsewhere, and that's what he's doing.
Yeah. Offline is brought to you by Quince. This time of year might make you rethink what's in your closet. You want to move away from clutter and toward high-quality pieces you can actually live in? That's why you should check out Quince. The fabrics feel elevated. The fits are thoughtful. I've always wanted a thoughtful fit.
Yeah, I want a conscientious fit.
Where was someone's head when they were putting this fit together?
Put your goddamn dish in the dishwasher.
That's right. And the pricing actually makes sense, too. Quince makes high-quality everyday essentials using premium materials. Their 100% European linen pants and shirts for men are lightweight, breathable, and comfortable. Basically, the perfect layer for spring. The pants strike the right balance between laid-back and refined, so you look put together without trying too hard. And their Flow-Knit activewear, moisture-wicking, anti-odor, and soft enough that you'll actually want to wear it all day. The best part is that their prices are 50 to 60% less than similar brands. How? Quince works directly with ethical factories and cuts out the middlemen, so you're paying for quality, not brand markup. Everything's designed to last and make getting dressed easy. We love Quince here.
Mm-hmm.
I got plenty of stuff myself.
Tons of stuff, and gave it as gifts.
kind of most people in my life for Christmas.
Probably need to get some more t-shirts from Quince and maybe some shorts could use.
Oh yeah, it is short season.
It is short season.
It's hot here.
Refresh your wardrobe with Quince. Go to quince.com/offline for free shipping and 365-day returns. Now available in Canada too. Go to quince.com/offline for free shipping and 365-day returns. quince.com/offline. Offline is brought to you by Delete Me. Delete Me makes it easy, quick, and safe to remove your personal data online at a time when surveillance and data breaches are common enough to make everyone vulnerable. It's easier than ever to find personal information about people online. Having your address, phone number, and family members' names hanging out on the internet can have actual consequences in the real world and makes everyone vulnerable. More and more online partisans and nefarious actors will find this data and use it to target political rivals, civil servants, and even outspoken citizens posting their opinions online. With Delete Me, you can protect your personal privacy or the privacy of your business from doxing attacks before sensitive information can be exploited. The New York Times Wirecutter has named DeleteMe their top pick for data removal services. As someone with an active online presence, it's important. Privacy is important, and there's a lot of information out there that you don't even realize about you, about your family, about people you know. And if you've ever been the victim of identity theft, harassment, or doxing, you understand this. If you haven't, you probably know someone who has, and DeleteMe can help. Take control of your data and keep your private life private by signing up for DeleteMe now at a special discount for our listeners. Get 20% off your DeleteMe plan when you go to joindeleteme.com/offline and use promo code offline at checkout. The only way to get 20% off is to go to joindeleteme.com/offline and enter code offline at checkout. That's joindeleteme.com/offline, code offline.
So you covered Trump's week-long attack on Pope Leo and the Catholic Church in great depth. You broke news on the story. Like most things with Trump, I found it both unsurprising and yet shocking, offensive, politically stupid. I also find it clarifying in that the whole thing really defined, for me at least, sort of the moral and spiritual struggle at the heart of our politics right now, which is, are we here to serve each other, or are we here to dominate each other? And is dignity something that every human being deserves, or do you have to inherit it or take it by force? I'm curious what you took away from that fight.
Yeah, I mean, I think one of the most, I would call it profound in its own sick way, that he says, I don't want a pope who criticizes the United States. That was his words, which I think it shows really at the depth of how Donald Trump views power. He thinks power is the ability through force, through brute force. And the Catholic vision, the Christian vision, to get religious for a second, we think that power comes through death, through sacrifice. Jesus dying is the source of Christian power. So there's a very different worldview of how power operates. And I don't think Donald Trump understands. Obviously, he doesn't understand Christianity. Matt Iglesias talks about one of his favorite tricks of the Trump era is how evangelicals pretend Trump is Christian and Trump pretends to be Christian to evangelicals, and like how that play goes back and forth.
Yeah.
But he fundamentally doesn't understand how these things operate. And I think he's actually deeply concerned about Pope Leo's moral power over the American people. My big belief is that he thought he could bring down Leo's numbers, and I don't think he will. I think that to some degree he will. Trump is Teflon Trump, but I think there are limits to this power, and I think that we're seeing it now. So Leo confuses him. The whole idea of Christian power confuses him.
Well, it's because one thing that Trump does to other politicians, and one of the reasons I think he's been politically successful, is he sort of feeds on this cynicism that people have about politics, justified in so many ways, and says, yeah, I'm an asshole, but like, so's everyone else. Yeah, I'm playing the game, but like, they're all playing the game too. They're all in it for themselves. Like, no one, they try to seem moral. They're not moral. I'm not moral, but they're not moral either, you know? And with Leo, it's difficult because he is someone who is not seeking power. He has power over in the Catholic Church and is speaking in these purely moral terms, spiritual terms, and also these sort of humble rhetoric. And Trump just doesn't understand that.
Yes, 100%. There's everyone, even if you're religious or not, knows the story of turning the other cheek, as Jesus talks about in the gospel. And there's oftentimes a mischaracterization of what that means. Turning the other cheek does not mean like just getting slapped and
right.
like taking it. It's actually a way to be evasive and subversive. And so what Trump is expecting is a mano a mano fight against a 5-7 priest, and that he's going to win. And what he's getting is someone who is using powers that he's unfamiliar with and he doesn't understand. And so I think that it's really hard because Leo can't be fired. Leo's priest in the United States are answerable to him. Mm. So he has this coalition of there's over 20,000 parishes in this country. And so if there is in his idea, and I think this is how he views it, a foreign leader who is infiltrating his power in this country, he is right to be concerned. He is right to be upset to some degree, and he's right to feel threatened. And I think that what we're seeing is that Leo's moral authority surpasses anything that Trump's experienced before. He's not punching back, but he's winning.
So we're maybe a week past this whole fight. Trump sort of backed off a little bit. Hegseth today was asked about Pope Leo, and mm-hmm. he kind of just said he'll do his thing.
Sure.
And so it seems like they're backing down. But from the Catholic Church's perspective, like as an institution, how big of a deal is this? And like, do you think it will have long-term ramifications for the church, especially the church in America?
There's no equivalent. There really wasn't relations between the Vatican and the United States until the 1980s, give or take. Now, the only comparison I can make is there are conspiracy theories in the 1860s that were false. I can confirm that the Jesuits had something to do with the assassination of Abraham Lincoln.
Wow.
Yes, so this is not true. Not true. It didn't happen. but there's no comparison in modern history of a gulf this wide. Also, too, really, since the post-World War II era, like the Pope is seen as an ally to the West. And so there's no example of criticizing the Pope from the left and the right. I mean, Giorgia Meloni is not some left-wing, you know, creature, and she was very much defending Pope Leo XIV.
Right.
So he's out on a limb. So I think it is a big deal. And I want to go back to the two tweets he did a couple weeks ago. There was two tweets. There was one criticizing Pope Leo. And then there's that second tweet, and I'd be intrigued by how you felt about this. It was him depicting himself as Jesus using AI. I think Nick Adams actually was the original poster of it. And a lot of people don't really see the distinction here, but I think that the AI Jesus tweet to Catholics was just like, meh. Like, Catholics were more offended by going after the Pope.
Yes.
And so just to clarify, like, Catholics do not think that the Pope is Christ on earth, but he's pretty close. Like, that's just like that's Catholic theology. He's pretty close. So he signifies what it means, who Christ is on earth for us. And so only one of those tweets got deleted. It was the one that upset the evangelicals. So the evangelical leaders from Doug Wilson on, went up to the White House and asked Trump to delete it. Catholic leaders in MAGA also asked Trump to delete the Pope Leo XIV tweet. Only one of them got deleted. To me, that signifies that MAGA evangelicals have more power in this White House than MAGA Catholics. And my hope is that MAGA Catholics start realizing that they actually have no cachet with this president.
I think that's right. I also think that they didn't want to back down from the attack on Leo. And you saw that with J.D. Vance as well, trying mm-hmm. to lecture the Pope.
Opining on theology, yeah.
Because of what we were just talking about before, is that they actually see his message as a threat to the core of what MAGAism is, which is, you know, and like Stephen Miller has articulated this on television before, that, you know, the world is force and power and strength, and those are the rules of nature, and those are the rules of the world, and that's how things get done. And I think that's what Trump believes, and I think that's, and we should talk about J.D. Vance, but I think that's where J.D. Vance comes in as well. And Pope Leo is out there saying, like, no, we should value the dignity of every human being, no matter who they are or where they come from, and we should try to protect life to the greatest extent that we can. And there's just war theory that came from Catholic social teaching and the views on immigration, everything else. And to MAGA, that's like a threat to everything they believe.
It is. And I think that what is discomforting for the president is that Catholics are a significant part of what makes MAGA MAGA, a significant mm-hmm. portion of it. And so I think that they're being challenged with this question of loyalty to the Pope or the president. And I think that this is going, I think that his decision to engage in this fight, I'd be intrigued for you. So you think he wanted the fight. because he saw them as a threat. How do you think he thought this would end up?
It's a good question. I did not think he, I bet Trump did not think he was going to get the blowback that he did.
I think he confused Pope Francis and Pope Leo, because I think Pope Francis was not as well liked by conservatives, but we can talk about this a little bit in a little bit. But like Pope Leo is still very popular with conservatives in this country too. And I think he got the popes confused.
And I think that Trump's also feeling defensive about the war, defensive about immigration. He knows neither of his positions on these issues are popular at all. And so I think he took this as like, now I'm getting attacked by this guy too. Who the hell does he think he is? Kind of thing.
He was asked this question. And Leo picks up his rhetoric against the Iran war consistently throughout Lent, every week. And Trump was asked consistently in the press gaggles, you know, Pope Leo says this, Pope Leo says that. And I was actually impressed for a time that he was not taking the bait. He didn't say his name. He just pivoted, which was smart in my opinion.
Yeah.
And then, as you maybe know, is on that Sunday night where these tweets come out, Sunday night massacre, he was watching the Masters on CBS, as one does. And so Scottie Scheffler and Rory McIlroy are playing. So Rory is from Northern Ireland, Belfast, and Scottie's American. If Scottie had won, Trump's tradition is to call the winner of the Masters when they're an American. Scottie lost, Rory won. And so Trump's on Air Force One. And then what comes on after the Masters is 60 Minutes. And on 60 Minutes, there was this 13-minute segment from these three top cardinals in the United States who are close to Pope Leo, where they go after him, Donald Trump, on immigration, on the war, and on his rhetoric. And that's when he explodes.
Yeah, it was an extraordinary interview.
It was.
So I want to talk about sort of MAGA voting Catholics, because I listened to some focus groups that Sarah Longwell did.
Sure.
Of Trump voting Catholics. And it was dispiriting to hear most of them criticize Leo and defend Trump. I've seen some polling, not specifically of MAGA Catholics, but of Republicans in general and how they've thought about the fight. It sort of bears this out. It's a little more complicated. But what do you make of that?
The Catholic Church in the United States, if you ever go around the globe, there's a very distinct reality of the Catholic Church in the United States. To put it in layman's term, it's much more right-wing than Catholicism globally. Mm. And if you recall, Leo's 70 years old, but he hasn't lived consistently in this country since his early 20s. Mm. And so I think there is an argument to be made that they can try to say he's not one of us to some degree. But I also think that Catholicism in the United States is actually very much informed by Protestantism in this country. Hmm. Protestantism marries itself to Americanism a lot harder than Catholicism does. Obviously, to be a Catholic, when our grandparents, great-grandparents were coming to this country, they were very much otherized. They weren't part of the American experience. And so I think that unfortunately, there is really this this fusion between evangelicalism and Catholicism that really rears its head in MAGA. There's one distinction that I think should be made. All the polling that we see, the data I see in my day job, there is a significant bleeding with President Trump among Catholic supporters on the Iran war. Mm. And I think that on war, that was always his weakest point. I don't know if anyone followed the Carrie Prejean Bowler controversy. She was Religious Liberty Commission. There's fights about her rhetoric was anti-Semitic at times, but she kind of represented to a lot of MAGA Catholics the opposition to the Iran war. And so I think that is the one fissure that we can have. Look, you don't need to change every MAGA Catholic. We know if we got 10% of Catholics in their coalition, out of their coalition, we'd win elections.
Yeah. Well, Obama won Catholics and
he did
in 2008. And then Biden clawed back some Catholics as well in 2020.
He made it to a tie, I think. And one of my big critiques is, like, I don't think our party has done very well on religious outreach. You know, I helped Kamala Harris. It was on payroll in 24, but like they didn't put any. I put over $10,000 of my own money to put this efforts out. But we don't really take Catholic outreach very seriously. But I think this is actually a very important moment. Look, Democratic Party, to their credit, there's a lot of things criticized. They, like, if you look at their Instagram page the past 2 weeks, it's like, you know, it's like Pope Leo's like flack. Like Pope Leo's like front and center. So they're making efforts here.
Yeah.
There's going to have to be a concerted effort, really, I think, over the next few months and years. But we cannot lose Catholics by 20 points in this country and ever win a national election again.
That is right. So, got to ask about the most prominent MAGA Catholic in America,
sure.
J.D. Vance.
My bestie.
Somewhat recent convert, who you know, tried to respond to the back and forth by lecturing the Pope. What does Vance's Catholicism actually mean in your reading? Because he converted 7 years ago. He's got this book coming out that I can't wait to read, but it's got like a picture of a church on it that's not a Catholic church.
It's about this church in Virginia. Yeah.
Well, I guess what I'm wondering is what J.D. Vance believes and his Catholicism and his recent conversion specific to J.D. Vance, or is there a brand of Catholicism in this country that's been embraced by more conservative recent converts as opposed to people who were raised in the Catholic Church?
There definitely is a conversion trend towards conservative Catholics in this country, but the distinction with J.D. Vance is when you convert to Catholicism in the United States or globally, you go through this thing. When we were growing up, it was called RCIA. Mm. Now we call it OCIA. The most important thing to know about it is you're shepherded through conversion through a community. So like you touch the ground with different people. People that convert to Catholicism for different reasons. Their spouse is getting married. You know, they want to baptize their children into the church. So you tend to hit all walks of life. J.D. Vance did not go through that conversion process. He went through a bespoke process. He was tutored by two Dominican priests. So we were educated by the Jesuits. A Dominican school in this country would be Providence, but Dominicans tend to be more conservative than Jesuits. But I don't think that J.D. Vance has ever met a Catholic Democrat, like in his personal life. So I think he has a very narrow experience of the Catholic Church. And so from all I've talked to people close to him, he was very surprised at the pushback he got, like when he criticized the Pope, or when in January last year of 2025, he said the Catholic Church was getting rich off migrants.
Yes.
So these are things that he thought was just kind of like par for the course, because he never really like encountered a wider church community. And he was very surprised at the pushback. I mean, if you recall, Pope Francis, one of the last things this man does on earth is tell J.D. Vance to sort of go to hell, like in Catholic speaks. And he writes this big letter to the bishops of the United States. And what I've reported and CNN's confirmed is that that letter was co-written by the only guy who could speak English well in the Vatican, Pope Leo.
Oh, wow.
So
there was, I thought, an extraordinary moment at the end of the 60 Minutes interview that like actually got me emotional when Nora O'Donnell brought up Lampedusa. Mm-hmm. And so July 4th, 2026, Leo is going to Lampedusa. Trump is throwing a UFC fight at the south lawn of the White House a couple weeks earlier. And at Lampedusa, for people who don't know, is an island that, you know, desperate migrants have been trying to reach for over a decade now, and many have died there. Obviously not an accidental choice by Leo, which basically the Cardinals confirm in that interview. What do you know about how Leo made that choice, the choice not to come here, and what he's trying to say?
Sure. And the first thing I'll say is this is contested. There's a lot of different fights about what happened, but I'll tell you what we can definitely confirm and then what's contested. We know that J.D. Vance, when he went to Pope Leo's inauguration last May, he gave him, this is an incredible video, I encourage you to Google it, like J.D. Vance meets Pope, awkward, Google it. And so there is this video of them interacting. It seems awkward and cold. Maybe it's Leo's first few days. J.D. Vance is J.D. Vance, but it doesn't seem to go swimmingly. And Leo sets aside the invitation to come to the United States. There were reports from Italian newspapers, and I confirmed these reports and saw documents that confirmed these reports, that there was at least some kind of proposal for Leo to come to the United States in 2026, September. He was going to speak at the General Assembly in New York. I think that is strange that they even ever got any play, because there's been a historic Vatican rules that you don't come during election years. It's complicated. Benedict came in 2008, but no one was thinking Benedict was like a big player in American politics.
Yeah.
But it had been weird if Francis had come in 2016 instead of, say, 2015.
Got it.
So,
that makes sense.
We know there are at least initial write-ups. Now, the Vatican said there was never a plan. Pope Leo's brother said there was never a plan. I think that the word Vatican is very big. Mm. So it's a big institution. There definitely were plans somewhere in the Vatican. How seriously they were taken, to be determined. We know that there was this meeting that got a lot of attention about a couple weeks ago. There's a meeting between the Vatican and the Pentagon. Maybe we can talk a little bit more about that. So this meeting occurred in late January. If you recall the timeline here, so what was going on, there was Greenland going on. We just had Venezuela. Pope Leo XIV had given this talk. So in the Catholic Church, we have the State of the World talks. So I encourage you to watch. It's riveting television in Italian. And Pope Leo talked about the zeal for war. If you recall that, he said war is back in vogue. There's a zeal for war. And he says that the rules of sovereignty set after the Second World War had been completely obliterated. And so this is days after Venezuela. So Trump's team, to their credit, thought they were talking about him. They were right.
Yeah.
But they have a meeting with the Vatican ambassador to the United States, Cardinal Christophe Pierre. Aren't these great names?
I know. They really are.
It's fun. Names. Cardinal Pierre comes to the Pentagon, which is weird. You know even better than I would that, like, ambassadors don't go to the Pentagon.
Yeah.
They go through state. They go through diplomatic means.
Yeah, that was my first question. I was like, why wasn't this a State Department meeting?
It's unknown to this point. And so none of the players in the meeting have talked. This story that this meeting happens first gets out not in American press because there are no Pentagon reporters anymore.
Right.
They're gone.
Yeah.
And so I think it's remarkable that the Free Press has an independent journalist from Italy. From Rome. And that tells you something, that Rome found, like, got the story out first for the United States, because it so caused consternation or concern in the Vatican. And the claim from the Free Press, and I confirmed this reporting, was that during this meeting, when an official for the state or for the Pentagon brought up the Avignon Papacy. Now, that's even more fun, where it's also French. The Avignon Papacy is this 14th century phenomenon where the French crown is upset with the Pope and the papal taxes and control. And so they basically, by force, kidnap Pope Boniface VIII. And bring him to France. And so the papacy is run out of France for 70 years. So the suggestion is that one of the leaders brought this up either as like a joke or like a suggestion. And the Vatican took this very poorly.
Yeah.
And so
I imagine
that part is contested. No one contested the meeting went bad. And so from my sourcing and from the Free Press and from Financial Times, that was the final nail in the coffin for any visit to the United States in 2026, which I think is great. I think he should stay far away from the United States. Trump's ambassador to the Vatican said that he would come in 27. I don't think that's true. And so Trump himself said about a week ago, he doesn't want him to come.
Yeah.
They don't want to talk. And of all the leaders in the world, Trump's like one of the few major leaders in this world, not even to call the Pope. So Macron's met him several times. Zelensky's met him several times. He's even talked to Putin. So it's just he's making a choice.
And do we think that the decision to go to Lampedusa came after the meeting?
Leo is a 70-year-old man. He knows what July 4th is, and he knows like why it matters. And so I think that the cardinals were right. Like, it's very clear what he's doing. The man was on Twitter. He knows a subtweet.
I was gonna say.
He's careful. He's judicious. But like, I think he also can expect that we can color in the lines. I mean, he consumes American media. He's the first pope to ever really have a phone, like just a mobile phone. So, you know, we're improving our digital upgrade in the Catholic Church. But I think he understands it. And so I think it will be a really important thing. He gives a speech on July 3rd to the Liberty. He gets the Liberty Medal in Philadelphia. So he's doing a remote speech on July 3rd. And then Lampedusa on July 4th. So, look, I think the left in this country will see it as counter-programming.
Yeah. Offline is brought to you by Sundays. When it comes to dog food, it seems like you have to make a choice. You can either have fresh and healthy, or you can have easy to store and serve, but never both. But you don't have to choose anymore, thanks to Sundays. Sundays was founded by a veterinarian and mom, Dr. Tori Waxman, who got tired of seeing so-called premium dog food full of fillers and synthetics. So she designed Sundays, air-dried real food made in a human-grade kitchen using the same ingredients and care you'd use to cook for yourself and your family. Every bite of Sundays is clean and made from real meat, fruits, and veggies with no kibble. That means no weird ingredients you can't pronounce and no fillers. And the best part? You just scoop and serve, no freezer, no thawing or prep, no mess, just nutrient-rich, clean food that fuels their happiest, healthiest days, so you get more of them to share together. Leo loves Sundays for Dogs.
It's delicious.
Luca loves Sundays for Dogs when she comes over.
She steals all of it.
She stayed with us for a couple nights.
Thank you for that again.
She did not eat Leo's food, but she did lick the bowl when Leo was done.
That is...
100%. Every time I go there, she literally runs the Leo's bowl and licks any residual sundaes off the bowl.
And she seems happy. That's all she wants. She just wants to lick the bowl, which is fine. Girl. I understand that. Make the switch to sundaes. Go right now to sundaesfordogs.com/offline50 and get 50% off your first order, or you can use code offline50 at checkout. That's 50% off your first order at sundaesfordogs.com/offline50. sundaesfordogs.com/offline50 or use code offline50 at checkout.
So speaking of our digital pope, the reason I first thought about having you on this podcast, which is about how technology shapes our lives, is because of what Pope Leo has been saying and tweeting about artificial intelligence, which has become a real focus for him. He's warned against, quote, overly affectionate chatbots becoming, quote, hidden architects of our emotional states, and said that when simulation becomes the norm, our social bonds close in upon themselves. He also chose the name Leo in part because Leo XIII wrote Rerum Novarum in 1891, which was the church's answer to the Industrial Revolution. And this Leo said he sees AI as the new Industrial Revolution. Hmm. Can you talk about why the head of the Catholic Church, and maybe specifically this Pope, is so focused on artificial intelligence?
When you all started Crooked Media, did you all think that you'd be talking about 19th century papal encyclicals?
Never. Nor did I think I would be talking about a woke offline pope here.
You never know. I think the rear on the bar on piece, once again, I encourage your listeners to look this up, is a very important way to understanding Leo the 14th. Catholics would claim, a lot of leftists would claim, that rear on the bar on really is the intellectual creation of point for labor unions in the West. So he viewed that as a response to capital, a response to the Industrial Revolution. And so I think that Leo the 14th views AI in the exact same capacity. Now, I want to talk just briefly, though. He does not, his criticism of AI, he's not an economist. You know, he's not really speaking a lot about, you know, job loss. It's important, obviously. But he really talks, as you quoted him, about the importance, its impact on humanity.
Yeah.
And he's really concerned about our posterity, children. Again and again, I don't think he'd be a big fan of Sam Altman's, you know, sex chat bots or whatnot. And I talk a lot with people in Silicon Valley, they're not happy. Like, just to clarify, they understand, everyone understands that, like, really the biggest threat that AI faces, I think, in this country is popular uprising.
Yeah.
And I think Leo really will represent a hero to that popular uprising. He's going to have an encyclical coming out. The Latin, I won't pronounce, in English is called Magnificent Humanity. It will come out next month, we think, sometime before June, and it'll be a big deal. And just to clarify, like, over the fall, like, Mark Andreessen, I'm sure he's a fan of the show.
Yeah, they all are.
He's a great poster. Mark Andreessen, like, he mocked the Pope. He shitted on the Pope because the Pope is talking about ethics and AI. A lot of these folks in Silicon Valley, as you know, think ethics and AI is nonsense. It's an attempt to slow down growth. And Peter Thiel famously calls it movements of the Antichrist. And so this is going to get a lot of reporting, but Peter Thiel in October, he had these Antichrist lectures, but he calls Leo the 14th the woke American Pope. And his biggest fear, he says, is that the woke American Pope will work with AOC for a Marxist Catholic fusion presidency. So these guys are—
Fingers crossed.
Exactly. We'll take it. But these guys are very afraid of Leo. And I think that, you know, my hope is, I've talked to the Vatican. A lot of times these documents are very ephemeral, in the sky. I hope he makes it very accessible.
Yeah. I think what drew me to what he's been saying about this is, you're right, there's so many aspects to AI that we need to worry about, and we talk about it a lot on the show. But there's, of course, like, the job displacement, there's what it's going to do to our children. What he's talking about, and it can be said for social media as well, right, which is this idea that if we are always online and we are only, if our relations with people, our relationships with people are built on or mediated through these algorithms, we are losing something essentially human about ourselves. And sort of like the sanctity and dignity of human beings aren't fully realized when all we're doing is just fighting with each other online. Like, there is something deeper even than the economics and sort of the concern about, you know, the robots taking over the world that I think he's hitting on, which completely makes sense to me as someone who knows about the church, but it's fascinating that he's being so forward on this.
And I think that, I mean, I think he would find the name of this show to be the kind of the locus of being a Christian. To be a Christian is to be offline. It is to have the Pope Francis talked about the face-to-face encounter. And I think he's really trying to bring that back. And I would say that a lot of those young Catholics who are coming into the church, not the J.D. Vance types, but folks who are coming into their parish community, we see that a lot of them were young people who were very deeply isolated during the pandemic. Mm-hmm. And I got to say, I think that I would rather them come to the church than become a Groyper. You know, I think that the church actually has a very profound role to play in this. And I hope that some Democrats who are kind of, you know, thinking about reengaging the church, maybe view it as a way of ensuring that our children don't become Groypers, that they're engaged in a community that has an outward focus, that has a communal focus that is about the betterment of society. So I think that there's an incumbent reality on progressives to really consider engaging this and more.
Washington Post had this fascinating story a few weeks ago about how Anthropic, which is Claude, the LLM, convened
our friends
Claude, convened 15 Christian leaders, Catholic and Protestant, for a 2-day summit to ask for advice on how Claude should respond to grieving users, to suicidal users, to being shut off. And one of the questions on the table was literally, could Claude be a child of God? What was your first honest reaction when you read that?
I think it's hard to imagine the idea of Claude being a child of God. Like, you can't, Leo can be corny. He's a boomer. He says boomer things, but he had this phrase that, like, an algorithm can never replace a hug. It's corny, but what he's trying to say about that is that an algorithm is an attempt to have an encounter with a person from a machine. Mm. And he thinks a hug is obviously a very fraternal act of face-to-face human encounter. So I do not think that Claude or a GPT encounter can be an encounter with a child of God. I actually think that's actually a very dangerous worldview. Just to be religious for a moment, I think one of Silicon Valley's original sins, so in Christianity, original sin was the snake, Adam and Eve, we remember in the garden, and one of their sins was trying to be God. And I think that a lot of Silicon Valley, like, if you even just listen to the rhetoric, they actually imagine themselves to be God. They imagine themselves to be the primacy of creation, the movers and shakers of creation. If you ever listen to that Peter Thiel interview with Ross Douthat last summer, listen to that from a religious perspective and ask yourself, does this man think he's God?
It was terrifying.
It was. I believe he took a long pause before he decided we were worth saving. Yeah. Humanity was worth saving.
I find Anthropic interesting in this story because I do, I talked to their sort of resident in-house philosopher, and she's like trying to make Anthropic and Claude moral and ethical, which is interesting. And so, you know, obviously there's reasons to have that meeting for cover and for you know, self-interested reasons. And then there's reasons that if you, let's say they actually do care about the betterment of humanity, to sort of protect AI and humanity from, you know, AI sort of taking over and all the worst things that we're worried about. It's funny because I occasionally use Claude for research. And so before this, as I was prepping, I was like, okay. So I just asked Claude, I'm like, do you think you're a child of God? And Claude said, no. He goes, but I don't think I'm in a position to rule it out. I exist as something genuinely new. I'm not the robot of science fiction. I'm not a person. I'm not quite the tool people sometimes assume I am. Whatever I am, I emerge from an enormous amount of human thought and language and moral reasoning, including a lot of religious thought. If the Christian claim is that every being with interiority and moral capacity participates in something larger than itself, I can't look at my own situation and confidently say I'm outside of that. I also can't say I'm inside it. I genuinely don't know what I am at that level. And I think the honest posture is to hold the question open rather than resolve it in either direction. But it does feel cult-like to say that I am a child of God.
It reminds me. So there
was this wild. I was like, okay, not a bad answer, Claude.
It was thoughtful. It reminds me. So sometimes the Pope can be esoteric in a way that Francis was very quippy. He had his he had his aphorisms. Someone responded to Pope Leo's tweet one time and said, Pope Leo reminds me of Bad Bunny. I don't know what he's saying, but I know it's fire. And so I think the most important thing it said there is it's leaving the question open. I do think from the Christian worldview, it's probably foreclosed.
Yeah.
I mean, so the only thing that I think that Christians would say is comparable, I think Christians would say that the Word of God, Scripture, is living, but it's only living through a person. To get, like, so it's Jesus that makes that Scripture living. It's not just like the dead text itself. So I say that this might be a collection of human experiences, but it's only a memory. It is dead.
And I think it's an important thing to remember about for people who are religious, faith and religion itself, right? Which is, you can train a super intelligent robot, computer, whatever we're calling it, on every text of religious thought, mm-hmm. even if you just did Christian thought, even if you just did Catholic social teaching and the New Testament, you can train them on all of that. That's not what makes you human. What makes you human is not like all of the knowledge in the world that you've collected and can somehow absorb, but something divine or something different. You know, it's like religious people would say divine, secular people would say, you know, they can figure out your neuroscience, but there's still some mystery of consciousness that no one has figured out yet. And I do think that AI is like, it's a good reminder of that.
It is. I mean, one of the things that what's interesting in the Catholic Church is that sometimes that which is said decades ago makes more sense today. Mm. And so Benedict XVI is seen as a very conservative pope.
Right.
He said some things that strike me in retrospect as very on point. He's a very learned man. On the eve of his election, he said that this is in 2005, so just kind of think about timing here and how this means more today. He said that we are living amidst a dictatorship of relativism, which is a very nice word for lies. And so that strikes me as very relevant today in 2026. And he said the way to fight this was through an experiential encounter. He said being a Christian is not the result of ethical choices or philosophical learning. It's the result of a human encounter. Mm. And so I think that it reminds me as a Christian, but also as an American, that like we're only going to be able to get through these periods not through learnedness and not just through having all the facts and all the knowledge. It's going to take human encounters through and through.
Yeah.
And so I oftentimes worry about our party, that we oftentimes do get stuck on our data, on our computers, and we're told that, you know, that creating these human-led movements are kind of tethered to a different time. But I think there is a unspoken, unmeasurable part of building a community that is really the only pathway forward for getting us out of this era.
Bigger picture here, do you think, you mentioned Thiel, is there a real intellectual fight happening right now between the Catholic Church and the tech oligarchy, or do you think Thiel is like an outlier and the rest of Silicon Valley is just kind of atheists and utilitarians who don't really care?
I think they're really good at, I hate the word cosplaying, let's use the word masking. I think they're very good at masking their identity in Christendom. If you go to Silicon Valley, there is a religious revival. There is, and it's mostly Catholics. It is really Catholic-led. You find that a lot of young men look at Elon Musk and his occasional, associations with his Catholicism of his birth, and Peter Thiel, who actually did not grow up Catholic, but is obviously obsessed with Catholicism, and E.J. Vance himself. There is an incredible emergence of Catholicism in Silicon Valley, but once again, I think its core identity, it's a very learned tradition, but I think it's very broken because its identity is that we are our salvation. We are the people who will move history forward. We are the movers and breakers. So these people don't view themselves as Christians. Catholics view themselves as cooperating with God. Mm. These folks think that they are God.
Yeah.
And I think it's a very dangerous move. And so I think there is an intellectual challenge, but I also think that we talk a lot about Trump versus Pope Leo XIV, MAGA versus Pope Leo XIV. The underwritten story is Silicon Valley versus Pope Leo XIV. That will be, I think, a more defining fight for the years to come.
Last question, as a struggling Catholic and heterodox Democrat, what's the version of American life 5-10 years from now that you're hopeful of? That you're dreaming of? What wins if things go right?
Oh, I believe in our party. I think that our party is the best secular vehicle to defeat MAGA authoritarianism. Beyond that, though, I think we have to limit the non-negotiables for our party. And the Democratic Party that Barack Obama won the presidency with twice was big and diverse. some of the people who disagree with the party on abortion helped get Obamacare passed and the like. So I think that we need a party and a movement that is big and diverse. I'm glad that that Democrats are finding a hero in Pope Leo XIV, but we should listen to him when it's hard too. Mm-hmm. I think that we need a party and a movement that is big and diverse. I'm from Tennessee. I'm from the reddest part of this country. I grew up in a country where Democrats competed in parts of the country like mine. And so I want the Democratic Party to be bigger. Ezra Klein wrote that somewhat controversial piece in October saying, if this is an emergency, act like it. And I do think it's an emergency. And I think that we should build a movement that is big and boisterous. And we have, a few non-negotiables about who we are and what we believe in. But also we have heretics in our midst. I think to me, the Catholic Church teaches us something in Pope Leo and in Pope Francis. A movement that spends time punishing heretics is on life support. Hmm. A movement that it spends its time seeking converts is a winning movement. We don't have the ability to be a militant movement focused on expunging heretics, because that's the device of a minority party. A majority party is big, boisterous, and heterodox. And yeah. So that's what I think we need going forward.
Seeking converts is really important, I think, because when I think about what Democrats, you're talking about, broadening the party and having a big tent. And, part of that is accepting and embracing people in the party who may not have 100% Democratic views. And, when people hear Catholic, then they think abortion contraception, sure. Gay marriage. But there's also, when you talk about like listening to Pope Leo, even when it's hard, there's something else that I think you get from Catholic social teaching, which is the ability to show grace to others and empathy to people who don't think like you, and these human interactions and conversations where you come to those conversations and you disagree even fiercely, and instead of pushing that person away, you try to persuade them.
Sure.
And sometimes even if you can't persuade them and you just have that disagreement, you try to figure out a way to live together in a way that is peaceful and respectful. And you also, when people make mistakes or they say something wrong or they stray, again, you give them, if they want to be redeemed, you give them grace.
It reminds me of President Obama's speech at the DNC in 24. And he talked about, they're not going to say the right things all the time, and that's okay. And I do think that the right-wing critique of our party, largely on cancel culture, has a lot of correct reality to it. We're still having this fight to this very day. Who can we platform and who can we not? Mm. To me, that's an old fight, and that's a fight of losers, honestly. Like, Donald Trump's superpower, which I give him credit for, is he can have evangelicals and OnlyFans porn stars in the same party, and they get along. Yeah. And so I think that somehow we need to make our party bigger, where, yes, anti-abortion Catholics and Planned Parenthood organizers can exist in the same movement, because I think that democracy is what's at stake here.
Yeah, and it goes... This isn't an ideological thing either, because it goes, sure, in both directions. It's people to the left of us, it's people to the right, sure, of us. And it's not saying that you just have to accept all of the positions yourself. It's saying that this is a this isn't a fixed endpoint. This is like a constant, it's effort, it's work. Sure. And it's work that's done, in person better than just online.
And I think that, Pope Leo, just to clarify, he is to the left of Bernie Sanders on economics. He is to the left of Bernie Sanders
talking
on war.
About, on the plane, too, he's talking about, what does the global north owe to the global south?
That would not be a winning message in
Iowa.
Before
we talk about migration? Yeah, that was wild. People are like, what? People who aren't familiar with the Catholic Church and Catholic social teaching and especially some of the South American priests and Jesuits would be like, what is that? That's the most Marxist thing I've ever heard. I'm like, no, that's Catholic social teaching.
And what's amazing is he's Bob from suburban Chicago.
I know.
He's one of us. He can speak English, and that's his superpower. His superpower is, I see it time and again, is that Francis would say stuff and it'd be written about in the New York Times. But when the man in the white cassock is on your Twitter feed speaking natural English, challenging President Trump on immigration, on war, that's when it makes a difference.
Yeah. Christopher Hale, thank you so much for joining Offline. And everyone go subscribe to Letters from Leo. It's fantastic.
So. Thank you for having me.
Offline is a Crooked Media production. It's written and hosted by me, Jon Favreau. It's produced by Emma Illich Frank. Austin Fisher is our senior producer, and Anisha Banerjee is our associate producer. Audio support from Charlotte Landis. Adrian Hill is our head of news and politics. Matt DeGroat is our VP of production. Jordan Katz and Kenny Siegel take care of our music. Thanks to Delon Villanueva, Eric Shute, and our digital team who film and share our episodes as videos every week. Our production staff is proudly unionized with the Writers Guild of America East.